Going?
Let's see.
Okay.
State's doing that.
Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for January 28, 2009. The governor's proposals are now out. We are in the process of getting the books printed up, and we will have copies for the members starting next week. And we do have a little bit of information that we already know about it. Apparently, within our jurisdictional area, the governor is proposing to spend about close to $17 million for technology upgrades, which is interesting and good. But apparently, it's also going to be, he's proposing on a lease-to-own basis over, I believe, about a 10-year period. So in the short run, we would get them, I think, sooner and cheaper, but in the long run, it'd be more expensive. And I think part of the presentation we're going to get today from the Department of Revenue is also going to go into a little bit of that. But we're going to know, again, a lot more on next week when we get the information for our budget division. So today, we knew that by the time the budget rollout would come, that we'd probably have some questions of the Department of Revenue and talk about the tax compliance issues and some overall recommendations as it applies to the Department of Revenue. So we do have the representatives of the department here today. And Commissioner Salamone, you're the person here today. Welcome back to the Budget Division. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dan Salamone, Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. With me is Dan Ostick, our Chief Financial Officer. I understand that you are interested in certain topics, including the compliance initiative, as well as our so-called integrated tax system project.
And what we've done, Commissioner, is that although we don't have the budget books available today, we did print out the portion dealing with the revenue department that would have been the budget book. So we actually have that information available today. So we do see what the presentations are. So to the extent that you want to go into the governor's recommendations for the department for the next 2 years, again, we've got that information for your agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did distribute some PowerPoint slides that I will walk you through. I think they will help us cover the ground that we need to cover here. We have adequate time for questions. So with that, I would, with your permission, I'll go right into the slides and walk you through what we have here. On the first page, we always like to put our mission statement out for everyone to see. Our mission is to make the revenue system work well for Minnesota, and we'll leave that statement up to various interpretations depending on the taxpayers. But our vision, more importantly, is that everyone pays the right amount of tax, no more, no less. So we have a clear focus on getting it right and making it right for taxpayers within the law. On the second page, top of the second page, you'll see a diagram that we call the compliance cycle. I think the real value in this diagram is to remind us all that compliance is a sort of circular thing. Every activity in the Department of Revenue directly or indirectly contributes to improved compliance with the tax laws. But in terms of working through that cycle, I would start at the top where it says inform. We have as our responsibility to interpret tax laws and inform taxpayers of their obligations and their rights. And so that's a very important piece of what we do at the Revenue Department. And then moving clockwise, we then have service as a second component. We provide taxpayers with the services and information they need to meet their obligations. About 90 to 95% of income tax collections come in without any effort on our part. That is, it's voluntary compliance. But to get that kind of level of voluntary compliance, you have to provide a lot of information, forms, instructions, be available to answer questions, and so on. So that's a big part of what we do. And then, of course, there's the processing of returns and payments. We have a huge accounting function, and we'll talk more about that when we get to this the integrated tax project. That's going to be a tremendous step forward for us. as we move forward with that project. But obviously, we have a lot of returns and payments that we process. We issue refunds, and we manage taxpayer accounts, much like any other financial institution would. On the bottom of the slide there, you'll see some of the statistics on who we serve. We have $3.6 million individual income tax returns, 165,000 withholding taxpayers, over 700,000 property tax refund claimants, 277,000 businesses that collect and remit sales tax, 191,000 corporate returns of various types, fiduciary returns, 50,000. I won't read all the numbers, but it gives you a sense of the volume of paper coming through our department. And it's really incumbent on us to do a good job of managing that paper and keeping good records on taxpayer information. Going back to the cycle at the top, we then have, after processing, of course, the next logical thing would be to audit returns. And our audit function, as you well know, since 2002 has been beefed up with specific legislative appropriations, where we were given an appropriation of X and we returned some multiple of that with new above-the-base revenue, and we've been very successful to date on that. And then, of course, audits generally are followed by enforcement of the tax laws, where taxpayers may need little encouragement to make their payments and to comply with the laws. And finally, we feel it a responsibility from time to time to bring forward recommendations for improvements in the tax structure, because we think tax administrators are some of the most knowledgeable people about how we can improve our tax system. So we do occasionally bring recommendations forward through the governor and sometimes more directly. Skipping then to page 3, a little more information on the scope of what we do. Annually, we provide forms and instructions to over 4 million taxpayers. We process over 9 million filing and payment transactions. We answer over 365,000 phone calls. I'm happy to say a very small percentage of those make it to my desk, but it's a lot of phone calls. 115,000 audits, and we assess over $300 million in taxes. Obviously, our department does get a lot of emails as well, 38,000 on an annual basis. When we talk about tax compliance, I made the point earlier that everything we do is related to compliance. That's why we exist. All of our employees, to some degree or other, are in the compliance business. It's a continuum from being barely involved in compliance to being very, very much involved in compliance. And so when we talk about the compliance section of the department, it's difficult to sort of put them into nice, neat boxes. But for purposes of the conversation today, and because of the compliance initiatives in the past, we've been sort of forced to create a distinction between what we call direct compliance activities and compliance support. And I list here the various divisions of the department that fall into those two buckets. So in the direct compliance category, we have the collection enforcement division, we have our corporate tax division, our criminal investigation division, our various tax divisions, income, petroleum, property, sales, special taxes, and withholding. Those are clearly all in the compliance business. Supporting those folks to various degrees are other divisions that have to do with sort of backroom functions. Obviously, we have an appeals and legal division, so when we get involved in litigation, we have in-house counsel to help us with that. We have the commissioner's office, obviously, the setting the direction for the agency and making key strategic decisions. Communications, it's important to be clear with our communications with taxpayers as well as legislators and others. And then financial management, Dan Ostick sitting next to me runs our financial management operation. It's important that we have good data on how things are going internally. And as well with our budget. In an agency of our size, our human resources division is also very strategic and important to us in getting the right kind of employees. And that's a challenge, as you know, for various reasons. I can talk about that later. Then we have information systems services, our whole IT operation is increasingly important. Tax operations is the processing of returns and payments of refunds. And then tax research, which is a little more of the academic part of the department. They're the ones who score the tax bills and tell you how much things cost and who's going to be impacted. And that's a growing entity in our department because the demands keep growing. So that's a distinction to keep in mind, the direct compliance versus compliance support. One of the reasons that it's important to make that distinction is if you look at the pie chart on page 4, go back to the 2000-2001 biennium, you'll see that 52% of our department was compliance support. 48% was direct compliance. If you look at the current, the upcoming biennium, 2010, it's our estimation that 33% of our department will be in compliance support and 57% will be in direct compliance. So that's a dramatic shift in the department away from the support function more toward the direct compliance activities, such as collecting and auditing and so on. And that's not by accident. I think it's been the case that when we had compliance initiatives in the past, we've been directed to focus those funds on the most direct compliance activities that we have, sort of the, and less so on the support end of the house. And so we expect that trend might continue. We are concerned about it because as you get sort of an imbalance of inputs, it's a little more difficult to keep things going. So it's a concern we would flag even at this point in the presentation that that's something we're concerned about. If you look at the bottom of page 4, there's a history of our complement, number of full-time employees or full-time equivalent, from 1996 to 2008. And you'll see a pattern where there's been a slight reduction in the period from 96 to 2000. Then beginning in 2002, we started getting into legislative compliance initiatives. And those initiatives required us to hire more auditors and collectors in order to bring in a targeted amount of revenue. So you'll see the growth from 2002, 1106, to in 2008, 1354. All of that, I would say almost all of that, increase as a result of those compliance initiatives.
Oh, set of rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Salamone, how many of the people that are involved in the audit, the compliance activities, are working on corporate income taxes? I don't mean sales tax audits. I mean franchise tax audits.
Hey, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I'm going to defer. Maybe Terry might have a number. Our corporate staff is fairly small relative to the rest of the compliance area. And
do you know?
I can get that number for you.
With
me.
I'm interested.
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
Senator Rest.
And I'd be interested in knowing what percentage of the of the audits that are done or at the corporate franchise tax.
Okay. Incentive okay. audits that are corporate.
Right. And I understand that the dollars will be the amount of dollars is not nearly as interesting to me because it's not the biggest part of the
right.
of the system. So that's nothing I need to know.
Okay. that. Top of page 5 is a snapshot of our department budget, $127 million for the two fiscal years, 10 and 11, for each of those fiscal years. So the total for the biennium is $254.8. And there's a breakdown by the various funds. In terms of challenges for the department, we have a very short list, but an important one. First of all, our probably most significant challenge right now is to follow through on the completion of the integrated tax system while still running our existing systems, our tax processing systems. I'll have more detail for you on this project, but as you know, we have been partially funded, for a modern, consolidated tax processing system. The system is used for almost all of our taxes, with probably the only exception being the property tax, which is kind of offline as a separate, almost a separate division. It's been a challenge to bring up this project, but I have a lot of good news to report to you today on the status of this report, of this project, and we are looking forward to continued funding to sort of get this thing completed on schedule. I'll come back to that. Second concern is a loss of institutional knowledge. I've been in this committee a number of times, I think, discussing this topic. We, like most agencies, are becoming more heavily staffed by older folks. And if you look at our distribution of employees by age in the department, and you put it on a graph, it would almost be kind of a U-shaped curve. We have a lot of young people now that we've been hiring in part because of the compliance initiatives. And on the other end of the distribution, you have a lot of folks who are nearing retirement. And we expect within the next 5 years, one out of every five of our senior leaders in our leadership in the department will be retiring. So it's a challenge for us to think about how do we manage. You know, in the middle of that curve, you have very few employees. You have a lot of young people who need to get up to speed fairly quickly to become future leaders of the department. So that's a real challenge for us. I call it the hollowing out of the age distribution of employees. When we have all those retirements, obviously we're going to lose a lot of institutional knowledge, and I know every agency is worried about that. Don't know what you can do about it, but it's a challenge for us. We in the past have reported on some problems with competing with the private sector for accountants, and many of our auditors are accountants. The market after Sarbanes-Oxley became very competitive. That has improved some. Also, it's improved for us because in the interim we struck an agreement with the Department of Employee Relations to have more accelerated advancement for our accountants so that we don't lose them. We did a study that showed after about 3 years, many of our accountants would leave the revenue department for either private sector jobs or IRS positions. So we did get some relief from that memo of understanding with the Department of Employee Relations, and that has been renewed for the current year. I mentioned earlier the growing stress on the compliance support part of the department. It's a concern I would just flag here. I don't have any particular solution other than we need to pay attention as we move forward to trying to restore some balance there. And finally, we continue to have a growing diverse population of both employees and taxpayers. That's a good thing, but it's also a challenge that we need to be able to communicate with taxpayers in multiple languages in different venues, and it's a challenge for us to do that. So this is our short list of challenges. We could probably add some others to it, but I thought we'd share that with you. On page six, we have our first change item that was submitted by the governor, and that relates to the integrated tax system that I mentioned earlier. I will note that that we had a strong argument for getting rid of the systems we had and replacing them with a unified, consolidated system. The case, I won't go into all the gory details, but in our old system, which is still largely in place, we're only about, you know, one-third of the way through the project. In our old systems, we had 142 different computer applications running on 11 different platforms for the 28 different taxes that we administer. Many of those computer systems were very old. In some cases, the vendors have told us they would not continue to support the software. We've had escalating operating costs as a result of trying to maintain these old systems. We were at great risk of systems collapsing and having a great disruption in the processing of tax returns. Under our old systems, when an employee moved from one division in the department to another, they had to get a whole set of new skills in order to understand the systems and the various processes that were unique to that tax. Under the integrated tax system, there are going to be unified, consistent processes across all the taxes so that people can move around the department fairly easily, and it'll give us a lot more flexibility as managers. We also lack, and to some extent still lack, the systems and tools we need to be more to do more intelligent audit selection. And we are making strides there. We've been working for the past 5 years with the University of Minnesota, an expert there, a professor there who's made a name for himself in data warehousing and data mining. We've been working with him and his graduate students, five graduate students, who have helped us start building a data file of the tax data, all kinds of tax information in one place. And now we're working on experimenting on various audit selections based on mining tools. So that will yield a lot of benefit down the road. With regard to the integrated tax system, when we advocated for that earlier, it was, I believe, in the 07 session, we made various arguments of why that would be a good thing to do. I've repeated that slide on the bottom of page 6. With the new system, we're going to have more accurate, timely, and complete information from a single computer system. I can't stress the importance of that enough. When you have 142 different systems, you're not likely to get consistent data from one to the other. So when a taxpayer calls, you often get conflicting information. That's got to be very frustrating to the taxpayer. So that getting information from a single source is going to be a real benefit to us. We will have the ability, we think, to expand and enhance services to taxpayers. Taxpayers ought to be able to tap in down the road and check their accounts and find out if their refund has been processed, find out if they have a balance due, things that we do with our own banks. We need to offer those kinds of services in the future. We have avoided some cost increases that would have occurred if we were maintaining the systems, the old systems that we have. We were able to redeploy some of those funds toward the cost of this new system. I'll break that down for you later. So the new system will have, as I mentioned, the same functionality, look and feel from one tax type to another. We expect down the road this new system will enhance our compliance. States that have implemented this integrated tax system have noted increases in revenue longer term. It would not be something that would follow immediately on completion of the project. If you go to page 7, I'll give you a brief update on where we are with this project. As I mentioned, we had brought this to the legislature in 2007, made the argument for it. We did get approval to move forward. We put together a proposal, a competitive proposal, for what we called a commercial off-the-shelf system. We did not want a customized job. We wanted an off-the-shelf package that we could easily maintain from year to year and buy updates from year to year and save a lot of money. So we did have the bid out there, and we awarded a contract in February of 2008 to a company called Fast Enterprises, a relatively small company with just a tremendous track record of being on time and on budget, and they have one line of business, the development of tax processing systems. Maybe this is not a surprise, but many of the principals of that company were recruited from tax departments around the state, around the country. So there are a number of tax administrators who are involved in setting up this software package.
Commissioner, where are they located?
Pardon?
Where is Fast Enterprises?
I believe
located?
They're out of Denver. Yeah, Denver, Colorado.
Okay.
So we engaged a contract with them in February, and work began in March of 2008. One of the unique things about this group is that they, besides being very confident and competent, they believe in having their staff on site almost full time. So we have 20 to 25 vendor employees in the revenue department right now working side by side with our employees to make sure this project gets done right and gets done on time. They take up residence in Minnesota. They're renting apartments, and they go home on weekends once in a while. So it's a great relationship we have with this vendor. There are four rollouts to this project. A rollout is a set of taxes that are going to be converted from the old systems to the new systems. I'm happy to report that rollout one, which involved a sales tax, the Minnesota care tax, the petroleum taxes, insurance taxes, the mortgage registry and deed taxes were all converted to the new system as of December 15th, 2008. On that date, we flipped the switch and we went from development to production. And I have a memo from some of the folks who were involved in that. One of the leaders in that project said that this was a flawless, it was an uneventful thing. We just flipped the switch and now we're on the new system for that set of taxes. That's a wonderful piece of news because having done it and had that success in rollout one, we certainly are looking forward to a similar outcome for rollout two, three, and four. Note also, just by way of interesting statistics, for rollout one, we converted 648,000 taxpayers over to the new system. And we've converted 3,355,000 prior tax returns, 2004 to the current, onto the new system. So we've made a great stride forward here, and we are expecting similar results as we move forward. The next slide shows the remaining three rollouts. The rollout number two, as you see, will focus on withholding, corporate franchise tax, S corporations, fiduciaries, partnerships, other business income taxes, rural electric co-ops, and the dry cleaner tax. And we are looking forward to having that rollout completed by the end of 2009. Rollout three will focus entirely on the individual income tax. You might not be surprised to see that we left the individual income tax toward the end of the project. We were not willing to roll the dice and roll out one with the individual income tax. There's just too much at stake there. But by the time we get to rollout three, I think we're going to be very confident that the individual income tax will convert without any problems. Rollout four will be completed a year later. That'll be the cigarette tax, the gambling tax, the liquor tax, and the non-tax debt portion of our collections operation. So that's kind of where we're going. We're partway there.
And rollout four would also include the health impact fee, I take it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
Let's see the slide.
Which
here.
Is also the cigarette tax. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this just programs or is this hardware too?
This is literally a software package that was developed by this company, Fast Enterprises. And the package itself is called GenTax, G-E-N-T-A-X. Internal and revenue, we've sort of branded the project as OneSource because all the data is now coming to us from OneSource. But it is as if we went to a vendor and bought Windows. It's all the bells and whistles are there. It's used in about, 15 states that have it now up and running. It seems like every time you turn around, another state is looking at it and contemplating implementing it. So they have a great track record. But it is literally off the shelf.
A follow-up, if I may.
Sure.
So what kind of shape is your hardware in then?
Pretty good. We related to this, we had to upgrade some of our servers. So we were able to do that. But we think we're in pretty good shape. We've done some testing of performance and seems to be within the limits that the vendors would like to see. So we're feeling pretty good about it.
So you don't have, like MAPS has got the 1968 vintage computer running.
Well, in some ways, has got the 68 computers, right?
You guys. Yeah.
Well, there's an analogy there. And when we talk about the 142 little systems, all the stuff was cobbled together with baling wire, if I can use that analogy. Most agencies have never gotten a big chunk of money for IT enhancements. And so we, like other agencies, coped. And we coped by building a lot of homemade systems. And as tax administrators, you got to worry about how stable those are and whether we can keep the thing going. And so we were very delighted to find out about this package, this GenTax package. And I personally went out and toured a number of states that had it and heard wonderful testimonies from the employees every tour that I had. There was just a lot of enthusiasm for this project and this product in particular. Sometime in the future, maybe you'll have a chance to talk to some of the principals on this. I think in terms of if you flip to page 8, we can review the status of the funding of this project. This project is a 5-year project, and I know I talked about 4-year rollout, but the fifth year is kind of a maintenance Thank you. The total cost of the project is $39.9 million. And some funding has already occurred. In the 07 session, we received $12 million as sort of a down payment. I'd like to think of it as a down payment. We also, as I mentioned earlier, were able to redirect about $11 million in funds over a five-year period away from systems we would have had to upgrade and shore up, these old systems. And we were able to divert that money to the new system. And then we had an opportunity to put aside $450,000 in carry-forward money. I think that was an opportunity given to us last session or the session before. We put $450,000 there. So if you do the math, 39.9 subtract out the pieces that we already have, you see that the balance is $16,450,000, a relatively small amount as systems go. At this point in time.
But this is new money that the governor is proposing.
This governor is proposing this money, right. And it's this money that is, you had mentioned, Mr. Chair, the right. lease purchase arrangement. It's proposed that this be funded that way, along with the MAPS program that I can't speak to the MAPS.
Sure.
I know it's
we'll
important
to
get my payroll
week, right.
check.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much where we're at with the integrated tax system. There's a lot of enthusiasm in the department, and if you have a chance to come and visit and can talk to some of our employees, you'll sense that right away, that they feel really great about what we're doing and where we're at. So it bodes well. Our second budget item is our reductions, our mandated reductions. And we had two targets. We had a $2.7 million unallotment goal for fiscal year 09. And that number was essentially 10% of our non-compliance unspent money. So we had to identify funds that were not in the compliance area and that were available for capture and redeployment, if you will. So the 2.7, I'll talk in a minute about the kinds of things we did to meet that goal. We also viewed that as an ongoing thing, so with the reductions we took in for 09, we planned to keep those policies and decisions in place through 10, 11, so that we get additional savings. Our goal for the next biennium, fiscal 10 and 11, was $8.26 million. That also is 10% of our agency non-compliance budget. And obviously, when you're cutting like that, there are implications, and we tried to minimize the impact on revenues to protect the base of our revenues. But we undoubtedly had to make cuts and changes in our support area, taxpayer information services to some extent, employee training. We'd love to do more training, but it's just difficult to do it when we have these kind of cuts to deal with. With all these new employees that are coming in, they need to be trained, and they need to be trained not just in all the traditional tax stuff. They need to be trained in GenTax, our new processing system. So we have quite a training challenge on our hands right now. We made some cuts in tax research. Hopefully you're still getting all the estimates you need. We also did some cutting in legal and appeals, property tax oversight activities. And we're trying to cut back on anything but the most essential technology purchases. So we're trying to really keep a tight lid. Page 9.
Well, before we move on, maybe I'd like to spend a minute or two talking about how these reductions might be affected. Because, again, I look back on page 3 where you list all the things annually you have to do and your direct compliance and compliance support. And you had mentioned then on page 4 how you're shifting, you know, more of your efforts going to be going into direct compliance. And is that because of the reductions you're going to have to do? It's just because the compliance support is being cut, so that is that why it's going that way?
It was a decision on our part, and I don't know if it was a mandate, but we are committed to raising a certain amount of funds based on our compliance initiatives. And we established, as a rule, not just for the general budget exercise, but even moving forward with various policies that we are putting in place, that we're not going to do anything to jeopardize the compliance end of the house. That's sort of fenced off. And so we imposed on ourselves the rule that we would try to not reduce the resources on the compliance end, take the cuts as much as possible on the support end of it. But we worry about, you know, if there are more iterations of this, it becomes more and more difficult. But I think, you know, we're probably close to the tipping point right now.
Okay. And we'll talk a little bit more tax compliance, you know, when we get to your budget proposals here. But when I'm looking at page 8, you know, and the agency reductions, you talk about reduction in support services and taxpayer information services and so forth. What do you anticipate that's going to mean? Taxpayer information services, are we not going to have the helplines or fewer helplines or longer waits? Or what ultimately does that translate to?
I think I'll answer it, and then maybe Dan might want to elaborate. But the topics that are listed, support services, taxpayer information services, these are general areas of the department, and we sort of left it up to the leadership of those units and divisions to determine how they were going to manage their cuts. I think it's safe to say that there will be minimal disruption, but I don't know that I could give you a list of exactly, you know, I know we're not, I'm not aware of any suspension, for example, of telephone service. Dan, do you have any?
Yeah, welcome to the budget division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, my name is Dan Ostick with the Department of Revenue. I'm their chief financial officer. Most of the cuts are coming from vacant positions or some layoffs that we will have experience over the next year and a half. We plan on 14 layoffs and leaving 38 vacant positions open from that were vacated because of retirements or just going to the private sector or the IRS. So most of the money that we cut is from that. You know, we have also put in the hiring restriction, travel restrictions, restricted training expenses, no achievement awards, no managerial salary increases, reduction of agency membership dues, more use of video conferencing, things like that to help us through this cut. We may see some decreases, possibly, in the tax operations side of the house, which is your return and payments. You know, there may be some delays. I don't think it will be very big, but it could happen. So I would say that's where most of the reductions are coming from.
Yeah, I think we would be interested in knowing, you know, again, because the slide says support activities affected by reduction. Now, if it's just attrition or things that are happening anyway, I guess we'd like to know what's actually being cut, what's going to happen naturally. One other thing, it says tax appeals. I don't think you control the number of appeals that come to you. So how do you reduce support activities for appeals when that's something that the taxpayers come to you on when they make their appeals?
Part of it's trying to do as much as possible what you're currently doing with less resources.
And okay.
So trying to look for efficiencies in how the work is done.
We
ask our directors to look for those kinds of things as a way of meeting their goals. So each of them had a goal. We sort of left it to them to
let's arrest
you with the details.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm interested in knowing how you value what's the price tag you put on a vacated position when you're calculating a cut. Is it a salary range, or is it the salary that the or a compensation package that the person had who left the position, or do you value it as if you were going to hire somebody at an entry position, or how do you get to that? And I'm sure that happens in other departments too, but we frequently hear that the way we're going to do budget cuts is just not hire people. How do you value that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest,
Drostick, yeah.
We usually take how we do the fiscal note process as well. We take a mid-range salary because you're never sure if you're going to get a person that is single or married, so the insurance costs can vary. Mm-hmm. So that's how we do it.
Mr. Chairman, that didn't answer my question.
Yeah, mid-range.
You just said with a married or single person? And then what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, what I mean is you take the salary for the position that was vacated, okay? The person you would hire in that position would be at a mid-range. That's how you average it. And then you, you know, the insurance can vary. So that's why we just take a midpoint of that salary range
so
plus benefits.
Each, for each, as you're building the budget cuts and adding those up, you take an average of the salary range and an average of the any additional compensation and say this position was worth is worth $75,000 to us as a budget cut.
That is correct.
And what about for the people you're laying off? How do you value them as a cut? The actual compensation paid to that person, or do you value it in a different way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, it is a little bit different because you have a position that's filled at that time. You have to take into account their severance pay as well, that you'll have to pay out in unemployment as well, so, if that's necessary. So that's how we do it there.
And so each one of those, Mr. Chairman, so each one of those positions of a laid-off person is calculated individually as opposed to an average for the vacated positions that you're not going to fill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that's somewhat correct, but we take an average of position, if it's a vacant position, within that division in that classification structure, so that's how we do it.
Mr. Chairman, just trying to establish
move
that.
Move the mic over a little bit because it's kind of loud at that end, sorry.
Just trying to establish that for vacated positions, you use a slightly different approach in terms of this average compensation within a division or wherever it is, as opposed to someone who's being laid off, which is a specific amount, calculated amount for that person who's being laid off, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that is correct, and it's a slight difference. It wouldn't be anything, you know, it's very slight. So
I'm not, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to figure out how you
yep.
do it.
Yep. You know, the position could be vacant for, you know, 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have
to just do it differently when you're firing somebody than when you're just not filling something, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's all I'm asking.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner, proceed.
I believe if you, Dan already mentioned some strategies. If you look at the top of page 9.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sen. Jungbar had a question. I saw him, but I...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess kind of on that same subject is, as we were going around that, and maybe we'll get more to it as we kind of go through the rest of, as we're talking through this, but, you know, the last several years, we always keep talking about compliance, that we need to put some more money towards compliance, and maybe that money is self-defeating in a economy like we're at now, because people maybe don't, even if they do owe, might not have the money to pay it right now, but... I kind of want to understand this holistically in terms of, yes, we can gain some efficiencies, but are we thinking, and is there some way you're going to convey to us at some point, at what time does this become self-defeating because we can't keep up on it and we can't make sure on the compliance issues that we're getting, we're basically bringing the money into the state coffers? I guess I'm... You know, as we're talking through that, we haven't really dealt with that. How do you balance all that out and know at which point did you don't have enough employees to keep the even balance, and it just seems like you've got a bigger job in many cases than most areas of the state.
Mr. Sure. Chair, Senator Jungbar, it's a challenge. There's no question about it. And we worry just as you worry about whether we can meet our commitments. You mentioned, you know, people may not be able to pay in today's economy. That's a whole new thing now that we need to factor in. So, and that's just one thing. We have space issues in the building. It used to be we had a building with a lot of empty space, but we did a good thing a couple of years ago, and we put the Office of Administrative Hearings in the Stassen building, and that's worked out really well. But we've lost some flexibility in terms of being able to house people. Training, I mentioned earlier, a tremendous issue. The fact that we have a lot of employees engaged in other kind of training in the department, Gentacs and so on. It's more difficult to find the time to train even the new people coming in to work on the compliance initiative. We're concerned about training issues. The economy is not as strong. So there are lots of reasons to worry about the ROI on the compliance initiative. You see on the bottom of page 9, we've had several of these. There's the whole history, and I should note that we have been successful in the past in bringing in more than what was promised. And we have been audited by the legislative auditor, so there's no, I don't think there's any lingering questions about whether we're playing with the base. I think we had a pretty good audit from them that certified that we were doing the books right. So we've had a compliance initiative starting in 2002, 2003 biennium, $10 million, $10.3 million. We raised 97.2. The goal was 60. So it was a nice amount of excess there. That was a 10-to-1 rate of return, or return on investment, if you will. Then the following biennium, we did another one, 12.8% for a goal of 659.8. We came in at 92.2. The thing to note here, though, as we've done more of these, the rate of return investment has gone down consistently, 10 to 1, 7.5 to 1, 6.4 to 1. We are now in the midst of doing two additional initiatives. One came to us from the 07 session. That was a $20.5 million appropriation for an expectation of 102.4 million. And as of the date of this slide, which was a couple days ago, there's $123.4 million collected so far. So we're already above the goal of that one. So that's good. I mean, it's good news. But even at that, it's a 6-to-1 rate of return, not the higher rates of return we had. And that may change. Usually these returns, these ROIs go down as time goes on, as expenses come in. In fiscal 09, in the 08 session, we got another initiative. That was a small $7 million initiative for a return of $21 million. And we are already above that at 24.5. So I'm not sure I'm addressing your point, but I worry about rates of return. And I'm an economist by training, and I know that when there are some fixed factors in whatever you're doing, you're going to hit a wall sooner or later where the returns, you're going to have diminishing returns. It's just a fact of life. So we are going to always be careful in revenue about any commitments we take on. We'll tell you the truth as to what we think we can do.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I think you got to most of it. The other part, as I was thinking, and in terms of other committees, it would seem harder to get efficiencies out of people in the department if you're all of a sudden cutting education and training budget out, because that's typically how you make the employees more efficient and understanding and being sure. able to utilize them across different programs and things. So I'm a little concerned in hearing that as well, how you can cut out of both ends of the cart and still keep a balance.
We cut very carefully, Senator, because that is a concern. Some of these things you could say are nice things but not critical, but in terms of training tax auditors and collectors and people to work on the systems, it really isn't an option. Now, we have done some things in the past that we were very, very proud of, and we've had to temporarily suspend. Like, for example, we have what we call a leadership academy within the department where we invite people to express an interest in management positions, and then we put together a program of training in-house. That's been very helpful in getting people into supervisory positions. In the past, tried to help out with tuition for employees who wanted to take job-related degrees, and we're cutting back on that now. But we tried to do whatever we could to sort of deal with this question about being able to attract accountants. It's not just money; it's workplace issues and flexibility, flex time, things like that. The list on the top of page 9 is our. Is a list of things that we did as a result of our need to cut the budget. And, as I mentioned earlier, our 09 cuts are extended into 10, 11. Dan mentioned we laid off 14 people and we're going to vacate 38 positions pretty much by retirements and other forms of attrition. new hires, any new hires that we have in revenue now are going to be only for compliance-related activities, very direct compliance-related activities. So it's an automatic. If I get a request for a new revenue tax specialist, should be basically an auditor, it's likely to get approved if the case can be made, a reasonable case can be made. If it's someone in some other level of the department, it might be a little more difficult to get. We have travel restriction. I believe that's a statewide thing now. We're encouraging our folks to use more video conferencing. We've got more cameras in the department now, fairly inexpensive. You can often now substitute a trip to some other part of the state with some video conferencing. I mentioned our reduction in training expenses. I think Dan mentioned achievement awards. We have suspended those. We hope that's temporary. None of this stuff is popular with employees, as you can imagine. One of the least popular was suspending service awards, you know, the 50, the 10-year watch, or whatever the case may be. We have closed some of our smaller offices outside of the state of Minnesota, New York, Rochester, Minnesota. And we have gotten fairly strict about our divisions having off-site meetings, where you go off to a hotel and you have a big management conference. We now insist that those be in-house to keep the cost down. So we're doing the reasonable things that we can do to get these budget cuts, hit our targets, and protect the base of the enterprise.
Let me pose a question or two. The tax compliance one that you've just gone over, it's my understanding the governor is not making any recommendations for further tax compliance money. I mean, we've gotten all the low-hanging fruit, but everything we can find off the tree. There just aren't any pockets out there that we could invest money in to still get a little bit more money back. Is that basically the view of the department at this time?
It's my understanding that he has not proposed any.
Okay. Now, and I just want to double-check if I make sure I understand, because I see the chart here. And members, again, you've got the packet of the budget from the budget book. We only are able to get the Department of Revenue for today. You'll have the full packets on Monday, but you do have the Revenue Department's book here. And so I'm looking at on page 3 where Commissioner Idenis is talking about the tax compliance initiatives, and it says history of successful tax compliance activities. And the last sentence says that the legislature appropriated $20.5 million to generate, this is 08 and 09, $102.4 million. It says, as of November 30th, this effort generated $87.9 million, or 86% of the anticipated amount. So he's referring to last November, and you're saying that this is still on track right now, and this is so 86 was in November.
86 is now 123.4.
Gotcha. Okay. I just want to make sure that I knew where we're at. Okay. 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 Sir Roebling.
I'm wondering if there's any recommendations from the department on what might make how flexibilities you could have to make things easier. And this will probably be handled in a tax committee. But, for example, I had a business in my district that was in trouble for not paying in their sales tax on time that they had collected. And they were told that until they paid that up that they would have their liquor license suspended. Well, without their liquor license, they almost needed to shut their doors. And then you have no hope of getting the money out of them that you would want to get, because they would not be in business any longer. But our state law was very clear. We looked it up. It was very clear that said you didn't have an option. It wasn't that you could try and work out in a deal that and you could suspend their liquor license or not. It was just that you had to suspend their liquor license. So have you looked at things that maybe would give you more flexibility in a difficult economic time when some businesses simply say, we can't get a loan to pay this, there's no way we can pay this right now, but we want them to stay in business and not have them shut their doors so that someday they can pay that off. Are there things like that that you're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senator ruling. I don't know that we've systematically looked for. I mean, we would be reluctant to do anything administratively for fear of, you know, we really want to treat taxpayers equitably and in a similar way. So doing deals, we would tend not to do them. It's much more comfortable when you have legislative language that tells you what you can and can't do. Our director of collections is here with us today, and she may want to share a few points on that. And while, when she's up here, we'll keep her here to talk about the financial institution matching program that was enacted recently.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Terry Steenbuck, and I'm the Director of the Collection Division for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And in response to that question, one of the things that we typically do, the action that you're talking about is a severe enforced collection action. So the taxpayer, the debtor, has the opportunity to set up a payment plan or make out other arrangements with us to voluntarily comply before we take that action. And if there is no compliance, then we do get to that action. And once we're at that, they're notified before we send an intent to revoke your license. And we give them another 45 days to comply. And if there's no response or comply, then we do get into revoking it. And once we've revoked it, there are no opportunities available. So there's been several opportunities prior to that time. And once we get into those enforced collection actions, then we need to see some results.
Sarah Limmer.
In that line of questions, the question I have is, it kind of works against itself. You have a individual who's a licensed professional. Let's say he happened to be in the real estate industry or contracting business, and with the fallout of the real estate market, it's going to be very difficult for that individual if he gets behind in a tax payment to make a payment. Then the state comes along wanting the money. Doesn't seem to be a whole lot of compassion going on in recognizing the real world, the real marketplace out there. And then the state comes along and says, oh, by the way, if you don't make that payment, now we're going to take your very livelihood away by taking your license as well. So is there any flexibility in the department at all in recognizing that type of marketplace condition?
Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Steenlock.
Again, there's many opportunities prior to the getting that point. We don't want to take that action either because it causes additional legwork on our end and an additional monitoring, and we recognize the hardship. But at the same point, we have an obligation to make sure we're living up to our mission statement as well, and that people are paying the right amount. And if those individuals come forward and comply with us, we can set up a reasonable payment plan for them. A lot of times, you know, people will say, I have a hardship experience, and we do have a very simple form that they can fill out sharing their expense information with us, and we can suspend their debt for a temporary period of time, and we reevaluate that. So there are options before we get to that point that, you know, people can call us or write us, and we will consider that before we get to enforced collection actions.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Lever.
I know a great number of people in that field, and I'm not really sensing that there's a lot of cooperation on the part of the state to recognize some of the hardship. And I've seen it firsthand. And I don't know if it takes legislative work to recognize hardship in particular markets, but let's take it to the furthest degree. You take the person's license. Now they really can't make any payment. So what are we really gaining as a result of that?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Taylor.
I don't have statistics with me today, but we do find a lot of success related to when we get to that point. Again, that is very much so a last effort that we would be taking. But we do see results as a result of revoking that license, where people are able to pay in full or are able to come forward. Again, there are processes where they can fill out forms, and we will look at their finances, and we can suspend it. We also have a stopgate measure in place where we have an advocate's office, so if somebody disagrees with the action or the situation that's happened to them, there is a third-party independent group that will analyze their situation and can overturn what's happened with us, or the decision may stand depending upon, you know, what information has been provided and what decision may be made.
Any other questions? Okay, Commissioner, did you want to finish up your presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chair. While Terry is at the table, I think it'd be helpful to go to the last slide on page 10.
This was an issue the banks had a lot of concerns about when we were here last year. So maybe you could tell us how the banks are cooperating or how it's working out for the data match program.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Members,
I think we've had a very successful relationship with the financial institutions through the implementation of this. They have been very cooperative. They've provided us with some suggestions that we have taken into consideration and implemented. As a result, I think we have a better process statewide as a result of their feedback, and we have reduced the expenses for them. There is a legislative study that is coming forward in the next couple of days here, and did find that the costs were not as significant as they had anticipated. And again, because of the feedback that they provided, we were able, I think, to make a better process for them. We did partner with the Department of Human Services, and we are using the same vendor. So when the financial institutions do their match, they only need to do it once now instead of once for us and once for the Department of Human Services. And that's something that we may not have thought about had we not had the partnership with them.
So. Okay. Questions on that one? I've got a couple of... It is loud out there. I do have a couple of questions, Commissioner, overall, and then I'm sure the division has some, too. Tell us a little bit more about the lease to own. Now, I'm looking at page 9 of the Revenue Department summaries, and it talks about the suggestion that the governor's recommendation of spending $16.45 million for development of new systems, and it would be lease to own. And how is that actually going to work now? Does somebody front the money? Does the legislature have to approve, provide the money? And have we calculated the long-term costs when we have to pay it back over a 10-year period instead of paying more up front as you would be if we just bought some of this new systems? What, you know, go in a little bit more detail about what lease to own really means.
Mr. Chair, I certainly could give you a dime's worth, but I think we've got people who know more than I do that from our finance department, MMB, Brian.
Sure.
Be able to help us out.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Brian Dahl. I'm the Executive Budget Officer for MMB, or excuse me, for the Department of Revenue with MMB.
And just describe what lease to own means. Who fronts the money? Is it the state or is it the vendor? When we're talking about the $16.45 million for development of a new system, but as a lease to own and paying for it over a 10-year period, have we figured out what the costs are going to be in the long run in doing that, as opposed to what it would cost if we paid for it just up front as we usually have in the past? I'm just trying to figure out how this is going to work.
Mr. Chair, if I may defer to Monday, we're presenting on this in full, and there'll be someone here who's a much more of an expert on it than I am.
Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit more on Monday. Another question I've got on page 11, there's a reference to a saving office rent by shifting employees from smaller office to telecommuting arrangements. Could you talk a little bit more about the rent issue and what will it mean if we if telecommuting? I mean, are we going to lose any controls and checks and balances over employees that we trust to work out of their home? Tell us a little bit more what direction we're going in there.
Mr. Chair, with regard to the closing of the offices, these are small offices, in many cases, 5 to 10 employees at the most. So we don't think that that's going to be a major issue. In one case, the office simply had to close because of some issues of mold. And so in terms of I've lost my the second part of your question, Mr. Chair, was
telecommunicating.
We have been pretty active in that for a number of years. I looked up the statistic before coming out here today. We have roughly about 30% of our employees in either a telecommuting arrangement or a flex time arrangement. It is a management challenge to have people working out of their home or in some other setting other than the main office. But we, because obviously now we can give people laptops, secure laptops and secure flash drives, we feel pretty confident that things will not we will not have any problems with disclosure issues. We also have a Citrix system now that allows us to transmit data through the system and have it be secure. Unlike, as you might recall, and as I keep trying to forget, the time where we put a tape in a package and lost it between Brainerd and St. Paul a number of years ago. We don't do that anymore. Everything is electronically transmitted and very secure. So we're not too concerned about the technology part of that. I think the challenge is supervisory. People call in. They're required to call in at certain times to report what they're doing and their productivity and so on. So it seems to be working for us, and employees certainly like the flexibility that it provides them.
Well, we've had Office of Enterprise Technology in here too, and Mr. Boozy, of course, is their security expert, and he's expressed quite a few concerns about overall technology, and I've often mentioned if somebody were to hack into the Department of Revenue's computer system successfully, it could cause all kinds of havoc. And so with all these new systems that we're buying and bringing up, are we confident that your security system overall is,
Mr. Chair,
always work on it, but how confident are you?
Mr. Chair, we have to be concerned about the IRS. They watch us closely. We've just gone through an IRS audit on security. And like every state, we had certain areas that they thought we needed to improve on, and we have responded to that. I will also tell you that Gentax, the security in Gentax is state of the art. It meets all of the requirements of the IRS. So we feel we're in pretty good shape on that front. We do have a small office of 2 or 3 employees in the department who for them it's their job to make sure that we are secure. So we do have a couple in-house people who are obsessed on that issue and make sure that we are as secure as we can be.
Yes, Senator Pappas, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You might have to speak in the microphone directly. So
what kind of employees are using telecommuting, and then does the state contribute to their infrastructure, whether it's their Wi-Fi or their DSL or whatever that they need at home in order to be able to telecommute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we certainly support those who are in telecommuting arrangements by providing secure laptops. I don't know whether we subsidize connections if they need a higher level of internet connection. I don't know whether we do support that. So that's part of the package. So I think the answer is we give them all the support they need to do what they would otherwise do in the office.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Pappas.
And then are these auditors, or who are these people? Are they people that are out in the field a lot?
Commissioner.
Maybe Terry can respond to the auditors. I suspect that many of them are.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Stanlock.
Members. It's a variety. We have both auditors and collectors that telecommute. When they do the telecommute, They are required to let us into their home, and we do a site inspection. They're required to have a place to lock up information. Their laptops must be cabled to something permanent that cannot be removed, so it can't just be cabled to the desk. It has to be cabled to something permanent. And they're subject to random inspections to make sure that data is kept confidential. But it is a nice way for us, too, to allow for some work-life balance and some flexible work arrangements. It is made available to employees who are performing well and who have performance metrics in place that we can analyze to make sure that they are performing regardless of, where they're located.
Mr. Chairman,
Sarah Pappas.
And then just one follow-up. Is it generally a mixed situation, you know, 2 days in the office, 3 days at home, or do they use, are they telecommuting full-time?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Jean-Lock.
It really depends upon the position. Our first priority is making sure that the customer is taken care of. So there's some technology functionality that we don't have available for them at home. For example, the telephone lines, the ACD system, they can't access that from their home location. So for those people, it may mean that they're working in the office 2 days a week and working at home other days of the week. If they don't have that functionality, then they may be an employee who works at home full-time, or it could be a mix of they're out in the field doing an audit and at home. So it really varies depending upon their position and what business needs need to be met.
Interesting.
I've got another question or two here. The legislative auditor has been spending quite a bit of time looking at a number of issues. Senator Rest is also on the Audit Commission, as is Senator Roebling. Issues of cell phone use, mileage reporting, and so forth, that there's been some abuses in those areas. I don't know if that's come up through your cycle yet, but do you see any problems in those issues, especially when you're talk about the telecommuting, and we're talking about these people moving around at offices? Those are things that seem to be on people's radar screen right now. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that we have a particular problem with cell phone usage or mileage.
Okay.
Dan is partly involved. Dan, one of Dan's functions is to sort of flag things that look out of line. We also have, I know there was some discussion recently about internal auditors and loss of some of those folks. We have two full-time internal auditors in revenue who, if we suspect any issues, I go to them and they launch an investigation and report back to me. So they report to me as part of the management structure. So we feel we've got a pretty good handle on those things. Obviously, we can't know everything, and
right.
If something comes to our attention, we jump on it.
Okay, Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, because you might have to audit somebody throughout the state, you're probably putting a lot of mileage on your vehicles, and I suspect you can't charge mileage to somebody for doing an audit, but if their audit isn't in compliance and there's a problem, is there an opportunity to bill them for their mileage and some of your time in those kinds of situations?
We certainly haven't done that.
That seems, Mr. Chair, pretty interesting to me, because if somebody, you know, I guess number one, they're out of compliance. I suppose it's like trying to collect on somebody who doesn't have car insurance, but that might be an opportunity for a little bit of additional revenue, because I can see we wouldn't want to bill somebody who's in compliance because they're following the rules, but somebody who is not in compliance, I would think we might have an opportunity to bill for mileage and the hourly cost of the auditor or something like that. It seems like that would be pretty appropriate.
Yeah. Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen, though, I would imagine people who are out of compliance, there are not only the tax liability but also the penalties for being late. And, you know, I would think that the penalty fees would be what we should consider covering the cost of – you know, the extra audits and mileage and things and the time.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to your line of questioning earlier, when is the last financial audit that was done on the Department of Revenue, and have you had a specific internal controls audit, and do you know whether you were scheduled for that?
You mean, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I believe last year, I think it was last year that we had a program audit, at a financial audit at Revenue.
Not a program audit, a financial audit.
Yep, they're currently in there right now. We have one every year as a Department of Revenue.
And in last year's audit by the legislative auditor, were there any findings?
I'm trying to remember.
Here's financial.
And if you don't know...
For correction purposes, you mean?
I'll ask. They know.
Yeah.
And if you don't know, I'll ask the question again on Monday.
Okay. Another question I've got. Commissioner Badgerow was talking about the lean initiatives and so forth to try to make things more efficient. And so, have you participated, as the Department of Revenue, participated in something similar to that, where you try to find better ways to do things? They seem to have identified some things that saved money within their particular areas and have helped some agencies do that. I don't know if that's been something that they've worked with Revenue on or not, though.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I've had some conversations with the administration about that. Because of the work we're doing on the integrated tax, it's our feeling, at least at the point that we're at right now, it would be pretty disruptive to sort of overlay the work that's going on gen tax with another sort of management thing. I'm very interested in the lean process. I've been doing some reading about it. Had conversations, as I said, with the administration, and sometime in the future we may engage them to go through the process for the Revenue Department. But I'm concerned about disrupting the implementation of the tax system at this point. Keep in mind that the nature of installing this integrated tax system requires us to look at all of our processes in the department for every tax. So there's at least a mandatory step where we have to sort of rethink, do we really need to keep having these letters or whatever? So there's, as part of the GenTax installation, we're questioning everything that we did in the past to determine whether it ought to be rolled forward into the new system or just jettisoned off as something not necessary. So there's a little of that going on. It's just not under the banner of lean. And when we get beyond integrated tax, I certainly would be very interested in seeing what we could do with admin.
Another question I've got, about a month or so ago on the Pensions Commission, we heard a presentation from Howard Bicker from the State Board of Investments, and I was quite concerned to make sure that we hadn't invested any pension funds with Bernie Madoff, and I was told we had not, which relieved me. But then I came back and I happened to meet with Commissioner Hansen right after that, and I just mentioned that, and I said, well, thank goodness we're out of the woods on that one. And his response to me was, well, it may not be the case, because although maybe we didn't invest the funds, we do have people in Minnesota that invested their money with Mr. Madoff, and they were expected to report some tax gains this year, where now they're going to report some significant tax losses. And obviously, you know, we're talking about individuals and tax returns and so forth, but and this may be a more appropriate question from the tax committee, but is this something that we may get caught up in as we look to the expected revenues, you know, this coming April for the state? Are people, is this going to be a, I mean, it's not going to be a huge amount, but it's going to be some money, obviously, that is going to switch around because of what's happening with this scandal.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that the February forecast might have some of that kind of stuff factored into it.
Okay.
I'm happy that we don't have to make the forecast in revenue. That's
right.
Come out of the Finance Department.
Okay.
I'm sure Tom Stinson has thought about that. There's probably a lot of other things like that are going to impact this forecast coming up. So
I guess we'll wait and see. Okay. Any other questions for the Department of Revenue? Anything else going on? Nothing further? Well, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
We may have to talk to you further as we get down the road. Again, members, as I indicated, next Monday we'll get Minnesota Management and Budget before us, and they will kind of give us a whole overview of what the governor's proposals are and the recommendations, including the issues I just asked about, the lease-to-own issues. We'll know more about that. And, again, it looks like, the governor's proposing to spend about $17 million in technology within our budget area, but it's leased to own, so I think we may need to, you know, flesh out the details on that. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes, you know,
before we close, yeah. I wonder if, in addition, when you're looking at that leased to own piece, if we could ask the department to look at, I guess my thought is that technology changes so rapidly. I mean, how current will the system be by the time we finally own it? You know, will it be just another
outdated computer
relic of electronic antiquity that you know, that we need to replace?
Well, those are the questions that. Those are exactly the things we need to ask. We also provide for you, I mean, there's a one-page document on vendor participation, public and private partnerships, as we're talking about some technology issues. Again, there's some thoughts about trying to have, frankly, the private sector take over some of the state technology functions, which might save some money but also raises other questions as to the long-range consequences on that. We want to know about that, so you might want to just look this over, maybe tuck it in your packet here for
OET.
Office of Enterprise Technology provides to us. Yes. OET, yes. And then you also have Mr. Lindeen, what's this?
Yeah, this is from a report that the Office of Technology came out with last January.
Okay, from last year. Okay. And then we also have the governor's unallotment, which happened in December, but is that list before you as well too, so you know how it how much did it affect our area at all? Did it any? Mr. Lindeen, the unallotments. I think Commissioner Salamone mentioned some of it, but
yeah, I guess the way this report is, and I haven't totaled it up for our area, I could do that,
sure.
But it just kind of goes through. It has them listed, you know, alphabetically there, and so there were allotments, and it kind of gives some of the detail: Department of Administration, the Governor's Office, the Legislature, Management and Budget, Department of Revenue. They're all kind of listed there.
Where's the Legislature on here?
Well, the Legislature, I mean, we're not subject to the unallotment process, but on the front page from the Commissioner, it was $2.2 million, yeah.
That was a recommendation the governor made as part of his overall unallotment, that he suggested the legislature also reduce our budget. So, okay, any further questions or anything further? Okay, we will meet next week. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you down the road. Thank you. Commission, the budget meeting is adjourned. It's Wednesday, right?